Our globalized world does offer hope for a solution to this sense of disenfranchisement and despair. The world that I described earlier, the one in which it is easier than ever before to see or hear strangers at our breakfast table, can also become a world in which it is easier than ever before to see strangers as essentially no different from ourselves. To achieve this, we need to do two things. First, we absolutely do need to find ways to provide access to information, access to the products that so many of you here deal with, to people all over the world. And second, we need to ensure that the information that is conveyed is truly global, diverse, pluralistic, and tolerant. And the substance is every bit as important as the means. I work a lot with the mass media, and the mass media that rings our globalized world still principally reflects the interests of its producers. What passes for international culture is usually the culture of the economically developed world. Ask yourselves who makes the cut to enter our global imagination in our brave new world. Yes, there's an occasional developing country voice, a third world voice, as they say, but it speaks a first world language. As far back as the first Congo Civil War of 1962, the journalist Edward Baer saw a TV newsman in a camp of violated Belgian nuns going around with his microphone and camera saying, "Anyone here been raped and speak English?" In other words, it was not enough to have suffered. One had to have suffered and be able to convey one's suffering in the language acceptable to the journalist. It is still the unfortunate truth that those speaking for their cultures in the globalized media are often not the most authentic representatives of them. Now, some, of course, particularly in Silicon Valley, believe that this is all old hat, that this can be overcome by the internet. And of course, we know that particularly in the developed world, the internet can become a democratizing tool. But that is not yet true in the developing world. The stark reality of the internet today is that there is a digital divide, that you can tell the rich from the poor by their internet connections or lack thereof. In fact, the internet information revolution today, unlike the French Revolution, is a revolution with a lot of liberty, some fraternity, and no equality. So the poverty line is not the only line about which we have to think. There is also the high-speed digital line, the fiber optic line, all the lines that exclude those who are literally not plugged in to the possibilities of our globalized world. The key to the internet divide is the computer keyboard. Those who do not have one risk marginalization. They do not converge across borders. Now, we know advances are being made, the growing strength of mobile phone usage in sub-Saharan Africa, promise of wired internet access in that part of the world. We know from the subcontinent the mushrooming of internet cafes everywhere. But it's only a beginning. The challenge is still enormous. If we, if all of you, can work to deliver development, if the unlimited entrepreneurship spoken about in that slogan is not limited to this part of the world, but to that, then, of course, we will see real progress. You will see people improving their lives everywhere. Now, I'm not foolish enough in an august assembly of entrepreneurs and experts in Silicon Valley to offer you advice about how best to ensure that people gain access to the technologies that you have invented. I will leave that to your imaginations. But I think it's important to remember that ignorance and prejudice, which are the handmaidens of propaganda and disruption, are absolutely the result of the lack of possibilities of convergence around the world. We've seen hate media, we've seen the disruptive forces that come up when genocidal ideologies take advantage of mass media in places like Bosnia and Rwanda. And one can say that if only half the effort had gone into teaching people what unites them and not what divides them, unspeakable horrors could have been prevented in so many countries around the world. Now, looking into what unites us, of course, brings us face to face with the issue of our individual identities. So if I take off my UN blue helmet for a minute and put on the topi of an Indian author, I would argue that India's recent experience with the global reach of Western consumer products, kept out of the country for so long, has conclusively demonstrated that one can drink Coca-Cola without becoming Coca-colonized. despite the fears of many nativists in India, Baywatch and burgers have not supplanted Bharatanatyam and Bhelpuri anywhere in India today. And India's own popular culture is also part of globalization. The products of Bollywood are exported to expatriate Indian communities abroad. And Indian music, Indian fashion, Indian movie stars are demonstrating new forms of convergence in the West today. With that convergence comes an interesting form of disruption. In England today, for example, Indian curry houses, as they call them, employ more people than the iron and steel, coal and shipbuilding industries combined. So the empire can strike back. Now, where does this leave the human imagination? Arun mentioned my first novel, The Great Indian Novel, in which I try to reinvent our 2,000-year-old epic, the Mahabharata, as a satirical retelling of the story of 20th century India from the British days to the present. In doing so, my motivation was a conscious one. Most developing countries are also formerly colonized countries, and one of the realities of colonialism is that it appropriated the cultural definition of its subject peoples. Writing about India in English, I could not but be aware of those who have done the same before me, others with a greater claim to the language, but a lesser claim to the land. And yet their stories are not my stories. Their heroes are not mine. And so in my fiction, I sought to reclaim my country's heritage for itself, to tell in an Indian voice a story of India. And let me stress a story of India, for there are always other stories and other Indians to tell them. How important is such a reassertion of identity in the face of the enormous challenges confronting a country like India? Can literature even matter in a land of poverty, suffering, and underdevelopment? The answer is yes. We're all familiar with the cliche that man cannot live by bread alone. Well, why eat bread? To survive. But why survive if it is only to eat more bread? The point of life is to be enriched by life. It is to reassert who we are, to say proudly, this is who we are, this is what we are proud of, this is what we want to be. And so in this process, culture and development, convergence and disruption are fundamentally linked and interdependent. And the task of those who produce these, whether it's folks like you, whether it's artists, writers, innovators, is to find new ways and revive old ones of expressing and transmitting this culture, just as society strives in the midst of globalization to find new ways of being and becoming. Globalization, its advocates say, is about growth and development, but it can never be just a set of figures of GNP tables. If people are to develop, it is unthinkable that they would develop without literature, without song and dance and music and myth, without stories about themselves, and in turn without expressing their views on their present lot and their future hopes. That's why development too is disruption, because development implies dynamism. Dynamism requires freedom, the freedom to create. Creativity requires, quite simply, imagination. But in speaking of a reassertion of imagination, I do not want to defend a closed construct. I believe Indians will not become any less Indian if, in Mahatma Gandhi's famous metaphor, we open the doors and windows of our country and let foreign winds blow through our house. For the winds of globalization, as I have said, must blow both ways. As the acolytes of Osama bin Laden or the young foot soldiers of the Taliban have taught us, the globe will always have more than a single imagination. And that is why tolerance is such a fundamental aspect of my theme. As someone once observed about water pollution, we all live downstream. We are all interconnected in today's world. But without a conscious cultivation of tolerance, we cannot understand how peoples of other races, religions, languages share the same dreams, the same hopes. Without tolerance, we cannot understand the myriad manifestations of the human condition, nor fully appreciate the universality of human aims and aspirations. And the biggest challenge to tolerance comes from the assault that the forces of both convergence and disruption make on our sense of identity. The author Benjamin Barber has written of the twin prospects facing humanity as jihad versus mechworld. And I'm quoting here, jihad in the name of 100 narrowly conceived fates against every kind of interdependence, he could have said convergence, against technology, against pop culture, against integrated markets, against modernity itself, versus a mechworld, and I'm quoting him again, of globalization run rampant, a world of fast music, fast computers, and fast food, with MTV, Macintosh, and McDonald's pressing nations into one culturally homogeneous theme park. Now, both jihad and mechworld, of course, end up by obliterating our most precious possession, our identity. And yet every one of us has many identities. Sometimes religion obliges us to deny the truth about our own complexity by obliterating the multiplicity inherent in our identities. So can we separate religion from identity? Can we dream of a world in which religion has an honored place, but where the need for spirituality will no longer be associated and confused with the need to belong? If identity can relate principally to citizenship rather than faith, to a land rather than a doctrine, and if that identity is one that can live in harmony with other identities, then you have convergence. Then we might resist both jihad and make world. And for that, we must promote pluralism. And that's something that I'll be very happy to talk about in more detail during the Q&A period to follow. Because I'm very conscious, thanks to a helpful lady in the front, that we are all like Egyptian mummies, pressed for time. And so I'm going to try and wrap up the major themes that I've tried to raise in this talk. In much of the world in which we live, there exist societies whose richness lies in their soul and not in their soil, whose past may offer more wealth than their present, whose imagination is more valuable than their technology. Recognizing that this might be the case, and affirming that tolerance and imagination are as central to humanity's sense of its own worth as the ability to eat and drink and sleep under a roof and one day to use a computer, is part of the challenge that lies before the world today. The only way to ensure that this challenge is met is to preserve cultural and imaginative freedom in all societies, to guarantee that individual voices find expression, that all ideas and forms of art and expression are enabled to flourish and contend for their place in the sun. We've heard in the past that the world must be made safe for democracy. That goal is increasingly being realized. It is now time for all of us to work to make the world safe for diversity. Since Arun told you that I'm a storyteller, I must end with a story. But it's not one of my own. It's an old Indian story from our Puranas, a story about truth. It seems that in ancient India, a brash young warrior sought the hand of a beautiful princess. The king, her father, thought the warrior was a bit too cocksure and callow. He told him he could only marry the princess once he had found truth. So the young warrior set out on a quest for truth. He went to temples and to monasteries, to mountaintops where sages meditated, and to forests where ascetics scourged themselves. But nowhere could he find truth. Despairing one day and seeking refuge from a thunderstorm, he found himself in a dank, musty cave. There in the darkness was an old hag, with warts on her face and matted hair, her skin hanging in folds from her bony limbs, her teeth broken, her breath malodorous. She greeted him. She seemed to know what he was looking for. They talked all night, and with each word she spoke, the warrior realized he had come to the end of his quest. She was truth. So in the morning when the storm broke, the warrior prepared to return to claim his bride. "Now that I have found truth," he said, "what shall I tell them at the palace about you?" The wizened old crone smiled. "Tell them," she said, "tell them that I'm young and beautiful." So truth is not always true. But that does not mean truth does not exist. Terrorists fail to see their victims as human beings entitled to their own imaginations. They see only objects, dispensable pawns in their drive for disruption. Our only effective answer to them must be to defiantly assert our own humanity, to say that each one of us, whoever we are and wherever we are, has the right to live, to love, to hope, to dream, and to aspire to a world in which everyone has that right. A world in which the scourge of terrorism is fought, but so also are the scourges of poverty, of famine, of illiteracy, of ill health, of injustice, of intolerance, and of human insecurity. A world, in other words, in which terror will have no chance to flourish. That could be the world of the 21st century that has just been born, the world that you're all assembled here to commemorate and celebrate. And it could yet be the most hopeful legacy of the horror that has given it birth. Thank you very much.